Okay, why don't you go back and repeat all the key things you were telling me if you can do that, if that's not a problem. I think that would be a good thing to do.
Right. Now, what I was telling you regarding the affidavit that I was telling you it's taking a tremendous amount of time to complete it because I'm going through the cold cases in the Toronto area, the York regional area, the Halton area, the whole of Ontario, and Canada. Now, the homicides, there's about 3,000 counting unsolved in Canada, and God knows how many that have not been identified because they've
now, you mentioned, who is the constable who was sent down to Haiti and killed?
Mark Burke. Mark yeah. Burke was an individual.
B-U-R-Q-U-E. Now, is it possible?
Two ways they spell his name, also with a K, but he told me it was with a C, because I spoke to him a number of occasions. He was in Ottawa. I was given his name. He called me first, actually. I was speaking to Ben Sauvé, and Ben Sauvé is B-E-N-S-O-U, I think V-E, Ben Sauvé. Anyway, I'm not quite sure of the last spelling, but Ben Sauvé was the former head of the RCMP and the Organized Crime Unit in Ottawa, based in Ottawa. So he was the one who gave my number to Mark Burke. And when I got into the cold cases of unsolved homicides and drug trafficking and human trafficking and all these items with Mark Burke, he knew exactly what I was talking about regarding the Camiso crime family and Clyde Forshaw, because Clyde Forshaw is the main hit person, murder-for-hire person for the Camiso family. Now, when I was seeing Clyde, I was trying to record everything that was happening within a time frame from 2000 to 2004. And the fellow who was arrested was Anthony Camiso. He was wanted by Interpol in Italy for crimes in Italy that were tried in absentia when Anthony Camiso was in Canada. Anthony Camiso came to Canada, set up his residence in Woodbridge, openly met with all the members of the Camiso family and Clyde, and I was privy to watching with the meetings. They met quite openly, and that's how blatant and brazen they are, because they know that there's the corruption in Canada and in the U.S., and it's been going on for decades. Now, what's come out of Quebec is an inquiry regarding this, I guess you would say, politicians and contracts that have been given. It's the Quebec Crime Commission, and there's hearings ongoing. And a lot of the mayors have been arrested, and a lot of them quickly retired or whatever, but they're under the gun right now, and an ongoing commission is being heard. Vito Rizzuto is coming up for the hearings. He was just let out of the Colorado prison for time that he had done for murders that he had committed in the state of New York regarding the Bonanno crime family there. So what's happened is there's multiple homicides happening with people that were going to be heard before the commission, and they were mowed down just in the past weeks.
Just in the past weeks.
That's right.
Holy shit.
That's right. So if you Google, I'll give you the names just last week. And I've now been keeping a tab of all the homicides that are ongoing. It's almost like a weekly affair to associates of Vito Rizzuto. This guy's last name is much like the film the godfather, the last name of the person that was mowed down last week was Corleone. Wasn't that Marlon Brando's?
Yeah, Corleone, yeah.
Corleone. And his name was Mario Corleone, who was mowed down last week. He's found in a car in an area. I'll give you the links to that, too, here. Let me try to look it up here. Mario, M-A-R, Corleone, I think I know how to spell. Anyway, what's happened is when the police force has come on to speak before, I saw a fellow that came from Ontario to speak before the Quebec inquiry. His name was Mike Amato, constable with York Regional Police in the organized crime section of the police force there. And he stated, and you'll see that on the CBC interview that was conducted, I guess, live right in before the commission. He had stated that organized crime is worse in Ontario than in Quebec, that it's people that don't sit down like what you see in the films with cigars and in the back rooms of, you know, their pizza parlor, whatever, they're businessmen who openly meet. And he said they are bankers, accountants, bus drivers. So as soon as I heard bus drivers, I was, holy moly, it's finally coming out. Clyde Forshaw was a bus driver and a streetcar driver for 30-odd years.
And that's to enable him to get around the city in an inconspicuous fashion?
He was able to, because he was doing various routes, Clyde, he was able to see the ongoings on a weekly basis of individuals coming in various areas. When he was a bus driver, he was actually working the area where the Camisos lived, so he would see who was coming and going on these buses. Mm-hmm. But a lot of the hits that he had done were women. One was Christine Prince that he had seen on the streetcar. So a lot of the unsolved crimes that Clyde had done is based on people that came on his streetcar. So he did the St. Clair route, the College route, Spadina route, the King route. He did the major streetcar routes and on an ongoing basis. Now, based on what I said to the organized crime unit at the day when they said, well, couldn't have been him because he was on the job. And I said, oh, really? Do you know for a fact he was using his occupation as an alibi? He could actually go to a dentist appointment, supposedly, but do a bank robbery or a murder, come in at the precise time when he logs out, but someone has jumped in to do a few hours at the time that he does a murder, and he's on the video coming in and punching his clock so they can see, oh, yeah, so he clocked in and he clocked out. But was he in on the streetcar? So as of my telling the organized crime unit, they put all these video cameras now on streetcars, buses, the subway, and everything, because I said, you don't know for a fact if he was. What if he had people that were supposed to monitor what he was doing on a daily basis paid off? And that's what Clyde told me. The inspectors that were supposed to say, yes, this man was on the job, were paid a lump sum every year from the Camiso family, every year, and then they get a free trip to Las Vegas. Of course, they blow their money there, and it's back in the organized crime coffers anyhow. So I used to laugh about that. Because Clyde used to do bank robberies as well.
Yeah.
During the day when he would just put his car out of service, park it where he knew he could park it, that it's out of commission. No one monitors where the streetcar is at any particular time. And he used to use the vehicle, a city contract, like city owns the TTC. Now they want to actually privatize it. So once it goes into privatization in Canada, that's where the organized crime will completely run everything. And that's what we're facing here in Toronto because of the cost. But anyway, what's coming out of this commission is very important, is huge amounts of kickbacks were paid by the Vito Rizzuto crime family to get the garbage contracts, the paving contracts, the building contracts. And Mike Amato, when he came before the commission, he stated that it's worse here in Ontario. So it was very interesting because right after the interview that was done regarding Mike Amato at the commission and Ben Sauvé, who also spoke, Ben Sauvé had stated that the organized crime is right into our political arena in the police enforcement and judicial. That means it's all covered. And Mike Amato said a very important thing. He said, organized crime wouldn't happen. There's a mandate, and the two play off of each other. They wouldn't be there. Organized crime wouldn't be there if it wasn't for payoff to government. So they've already done this way back when to keep themselves alive. And when I see the hefty amount, this is what I faced every time that I go to the police force, try to give the information. The person quickly retires, gets a massive pension, and never speaks about the case. Then it's handed like a baton to the next two guys that do a contract, take the information, just waylay it. They don't do anything, and these cold cases remain unresolved, and they do it purposely. I can see that. Well, so I was sort of
Don't you imagine there's somebody higher up than the constable who tipped them off that the constable was becoming involved,
right, well,
and directed him to Haiti to be murdered?
I would suspect this is what I see. Mike Amato spoke about this, about the businessmen right in high positions. So somebody is pulling the strings somewhere. And I would say because he died, Mark Burke died right before UN peacekeepers on the streets of Haiti with a tourniquet on the wrong leg. The peacekeepers, the UN peacekeepers, did nothing to help him and just watched him bleed to death. I suspect that that was a payback for his taking down the crime families. Why was this RCMP officer sent down to Haiti in the first place? I was sort of flabbergasted
sure.
that he would go into a place like that after working in Canada for 30 years.
Sure.
If you gave me all the money in the world, I wouldn't go to Haiti.
Yeah.
That's one of the worst places on the planet to be for, the organized crime. See, it moves actually through the Caribbean via Haiti up again through the coastal areas and goes into Montreal again through that port city. So right now there's a big, I don't know how to say it, a huge point right now. They're trying to take down probably this Vito Rizzuto as well. There's a fight for the control of the port city of Montreal, because that's the key link where it would it will come in through freighter, whatever, through the, through the link of the St. Lawrence River into the Great Lakes. It's easily moved through freighters that come in through there, smaller ships that work their way through the seaway area. So drugs come in various ways. It used to be coming in through the airports, and then they'd have baggage handlers that would work taking off the baggage. Then years ago, it was through private planes flying, like David Ferry was one of the links from New Orleans that would fly these planes.
Haley, hang on a second. I got to take a phone call here. Just one second.
Sure.
Yeah, babe, what's up? What's up? Yeah, I did. That's okay. That's okay. That's okay. Yeah, I'm okay. I'm okay. Thanks, babe. Good. No, I'm just doing a recording. That's all. It's good. It's good. Thanks. Bye. Haley, go ahead.
Right. So I actually, when I started now looking on the internet regarding James Earl Ray and the hearings that were heard, I actually found a picture of my brother with a different name, of course, and it must have been taken at a border crossing or somewhere. But I can identify the picture of my brother as being the Raul. So when they showed the picture, I guess, to James Earl Ray, he identified it, and when I saw it, I was sort of flabbergasted. But of course, you know, there was a different name used.
Raul was your brother?
Raul was my brother, right?
Is he
Actually,
still alive?
I don't know. When I asked Mike Amato, I said I'd heard rumor that my brother is dead. I don't know if my brother's gone into, you know, witness protection. Maybe he was killed. I don't know. I had no authoritative figure come to me and say, "Your police, like we're police, and we're now stating that your brother." His body's been found. Nobody came to me regarding that. And I'm a blood relative, the closest to him, and I don't understand if he is dead. And I heard rumor, and it's on the internet, that there was a memorial held. So I don't know. I have no idea. No one stated, you know, what had happened to him or whatever. So I have no idea. But if, like in the movie JFK, it says that anyone that was part of the assassination team will never be tried for anything that they ever do, and who stated that was Fletcher Prouty in the movie, but he was known as Mr. X, if you remember
Right.
seeing it, that the actor Donald Sutherland played that part. But I surmise that could be the case. Completely. So I am probably the only living witness that had seen and known Walter Chabinsky. Like I said, he's the person who people thought was this Braden fellow. But if you take a look, like I stated, what Braden was wearing at the Dealey Plaza, he had the radio walkie-talkie system.
Right.
But it's the shooter right at the front who was wearing a gauzy. You would call it an Egyptian cotton outfit. And if you take a look at what Eric Braden was wearing and Walter Chabinsky was wearing, it's two different outfits. So when I pointed out, it's right in the Zapruder film that the shooter that does the shot in the throat, JFK's throat, is right in the open. It was done with a silencer, a special gun that had no sound to it. Just the swinging of the left arm in the back, you saw that the motion was held. And why is this guy walking with around that Dealey Plaza with the bulletproof vest right in front in the open?
Where
So
was
the
he?
various shots.
Where was he
Sorry?
standing? Where was he standing when he fired this shot?
Well, when you see the Zapruder film, when you watch in the slow motion the digitally enhanced Zapruder film, it's right after the Simmons Freeway sign. There's a little girl skipping.
Yeah.
Simmons Freeway. Let me just Google here the Simmons or the Zapruder film. Zapruder film.
Of course, that shot to the throat occurred before the or behind the Zapruder, the Stemmons sign.
Videos of Zapruder film. So when you go into the digitally enhanced, in slow motion, you can actually see it. I'm just looking at it here now, click to view.
Where was he standing in relation to the?
he was standing here. I'll show you when they do a close-up.
Okay, hang on. I'll go there too. What link are you using?
Hold on here. I'm putting JFK's Zapruder film.
Yes.
Okay.
And you're talking about slow motion.
There. I'm doing actually fast motion. Okay, I'll go back to it. Now there's a commercial. Hold on here. You always have to watch these. I'll do it again. Click to view. It just says JFK colon Zapruder film. So when you watch it, there's a Simmons Freeway sign that comes.
Just one second. Let me see if I can find just what you're looking at. And is it the slow-mo or you just, okay, JFK?
The slow motion. Well, the first look at the quick motion. There's a little girl with the, and there he is. Whoops. I have to go back. It happened so fast. Let me try to put it in a pause. So the actual frame of the shot.
Is this under How Stuff Works? How Stuff Works videos?
Yeah, How Stuff. We're on the same page. Exactly, James.
That's an old one, 2008.
Yeah. Now, the digitally enhanced really shows it up. But let me go back there. How Stuff Works, JFK. So we're on the same. Now, I clicked into the third one, and I'll try to pause it. Now, when you see the limousine coming,
mm-hmm.
There's a post. Are we clicking on? There's a lady right before the post that looks like a blue kerchief or whatever, then a brunette lady, then a black-haired lady, then a lady with a plink blouse. Standing beside, there's a sort of beige or yellow lady before that sign as well. Are we clicking into the same?
Well, let me see. You're talking about
the
bystanders just before the sign.
Right. There's the first Zapruder film shows slow motion 255. Then it says 5 colon 49 Zapruder film digitally remastered. And then How Stuff Works. That's the one I'm going to click now. If we click the same thing.
Yeah.
It's the third. Click to view. Okay, so now it starts. Now you see the bicycle, policemen on the bikes, and then you see the limo going behind the Zapruder film. Now you see...
Behind the Stemmons sign.
Right. He's right on the other side of, I guess you would say, Elm Street. There's a black fellow with a fedora hat that's standing right beside him. And Walter Dubinsky is the fellow with the bulletproof vest standing right in front of the black fellow with the... I get this crazy commercial with an 8 there now. Hold on here.
You're talking about the Umbrella Man?
No, not the Umbrella Man.
Okay, I'm not sure I'm on the same one with you. I'm looking at JFK's Zapruder film. You want me to get to some...
Okay, here it goes again.
High...
Okay, where he's standing, Walter Dubinsky is standing, right after the Simmons Freeway sign, the limo comes out from behind the freeway sign.
And is he in the foreground or the background?
He's in the foreground. Now you see him right there. He just did the throat shot.
Just wait a second.
Yeah, I'm going to try to pause it. It's all in Eric Groden's film.
Robert Groden's film. Well, there are only two people I see beside the sign. One is the Umbrella Man, and the other is the Cuban raising his fist.
No. That's on that side. It's on the north side, the other side. Okay, let me try to pause it right where it happens. The Umbrella Man is on one side, and this is on the other side.
Well, the other side's the south side, not the north side.
Okay, the south side. Where's the little girl with the red dress?
Yeah,
and the
she's
white,
on the south side.
Okay, that's where it is. Now, that's where Walter Jabinski is at.
Let's see if we can...
And I'm going to try to pause it right after the Simmons Freeway. I'm going to see if it will pause.
Okay.
I don't know, because this thing doesn't work good. Now a commercial comes on. Good grief.
Let me see if that digitally
remastered. It's best when it goes into slow motion because you can actually pause it better.
And yeah, I just want to figure out where it is. Just a minute.
In America, they don't ask questions of who is this fellow with a bulletproof vest right at the
end. Oh, I see who you're talking about. Who's beside him? There's a black man beside him?
With a fedora hat.
So you think that's Walter's... Spell his name.
Walter, W-A-L-T-E-R, Tabinski, T-A-B-I-N-S-K-I.
And he does look like he's wearing a bulletproof vest.
He's got a bulletproof vest. He's wearing a gauze-type outfit that are loose pants. If you put the picture of Braden's wearing a completely different outfit, kind of like a khaki colored or whatever.
Braden's not in the Zapruder film that I know, is he?
No, he's not.
Right.
He was just there as a walkie-talkie person saying it was coordinated, the timing of the limo coming through at what point. Each person had a role to play there where the crossfire happened. So the walkie-talkie people kept these guys in sync with it. That's the way Clyde does his hits. He would always, I took a photo of his walkie-talkie. The Camiso brothers bought it for him. Very specialized walkie-talkie. His favorite line, target on track. That's his favorite phrase. Favorite word, target. I thought, oh my God, how many targets have you gone through your lifetime already? But anyway, what's so important is this fellow has never been analyzed from the JFK assassination time. This is 49 years, next year will be 50 years, and no one said, who is this fellow at Dealey Plaza with the bulletproof vest? Please tell me, right? This is what people have not analyzed. Why do they analyze the Umbrella Man? And that's why it's been waylaid even by Fletcher Prouty. Why didn't Garrison analyze? They looked at the Zapruder film right in court. Why weren't they analyzing it there? I'm surprised at America. I'm surprised at how many people have viewed this.
Well, it's because the government was running the whole thing. It's because they were covering it up. They weren't trying to solve it. Haley, this isn't a big fucking mystery as to why they didn't solve it. They didn't want to solve it because they did it.
That's right. And this is why they don't want these crimes solved in Ontario. That's why I've been waylaid. Any police officer that's not corrupt is killed.
That's right.
And this is why they've all been quiet. So I was actually quite amazed at Mike Amato coming forth. I praised him for his courage to do that. And I said, look, this has bothered me all my life. All my life I've been threatened by Clyde all the time, him telling me for years. I get phone calls when you least expect it, you're going to die. I can't walk down the street without looking all the time who's behind me. How many times he's cased my most recent residence, which I saw that he already did. One day he came by, he threw a deck of, well, it looked like a deck of cards that he threw, but it wasn't a deck of cards, it was just some little flyers or whatever that he had in his hand. And he stooped to pick them up, but as he was stooping, he was taking a good look at, you know, every little inch of the house I was living in, thinking of, you know, how he's going to shoot me. Because he used sniper rifles. The one place that I lived in, I flung myself to the ground really quickly because I had a laser beam, a green laser beam coming in, and he was using, a high-powered rifle that had night vision on it. So he was. I quickly put the lights out, on the ground.
Good for you.
I mean, this is the type of thing I've had to do all my life, so I don't know when I go. As soon as I go to the police, they probably say, this is like that stupid Detective Sergeant Tony Smith. He calls up Clyde and tells Clyde that Haley's been taping you. What are you going to do about it? This is a cop that's been paid off. Then Clyde calls me and he says, hey, Detective Sergeant Tony Smith just told me that you've been taping me. And I said, what are you talking about? His last line, that he always used to yell at me. What are you talking about? I'm yelling at him. This is how the police wanted Clyde to kill me.
Yeah.
To get rid of me because I have so much evidence.
Sure.
Against him. I have an evidence going back into all the key players in the assassination of Kennedy, Martin Luther King, and Bobby Kennedy. And I met with saw David Ferry, Clay Shaw, also known as Bertram Shaw. I saw these people in the...
Clay Bertram.
Clay Bertram, because he had a corporation going on in Quebec that was actually opened up in Italy, corporation that he had. It was a link between arms being moved from...
Haley, who'd you get to be the key killers in the case of Martin Luther King? Your own brother, was he wasn't the shooter, though, was he?
No, Clyde actually told me, this is what he told me, that it was the cousin who was down below the bushes who did the shot. So a lot of the pictures that comes out is a fellow's tracks are all underneath the window of a guy with big feet, big boot marks right in the back of the I forget the name of it. Well, behind
You don't mean the Lorraine Hotel?
No, not Lorraine Hotel. Hold on, let me just. What's the name of the place that was directly caused? It was the rooming house, but there was a small little.
There was a little restaurant there.
That's right. Well, anyway, behind the restaurant, there were bushes,
right.
And there's photos that I'm going to actually put. The next thing I'm going to do is buy a scanner. And from the books that I've looked at, you could actually see Clyde's cousin, Walter Tobinski, walking around pretending as if he's an NSA guy from the National Security Agency.
Mm-hmm.
And he's picking up the cartridges or the spent cartridges there that were made sure there was nothing left.
Well, so I think only one shot was fired.
That's right. But anyway, he was so brazen enough, he just comes in and pretends as if he's an authority figure and no one questions who the heck he was, right? Anyway, he did the shot underneath the bushes. There was a diversionary shot done from the window, from the bathroom, on purpose so people would point in the wrong direction. But it's the same technique that was used. A gun had a silencer from the area that was actually a shot came in, and the ballistics can tell that. So they've already sort of analyzed where the shots came from that entered the body. And the same setup as the JFK, put the rifle in the front. James Earl Ray left it, get his thumbprint or some fingerprint on there to put the blame on the Patsy again. So the key things that assassins or whatever set up the patsy, get an alibi, make sure everything is clean, that the crime scene is clean, that they can't put you to anything, and make sure that you pay off all the government figures or that they're part of it. So when you see this whole thing, it's so extensive with Martin Luther King, the same way they did Bobby Kennedy.
Tell me about Bobby.
Well, with the Bobby, Clyde discussed about this woman with the pink or the polka dot dress
that
was seen at the scene. And it was done much like the movie The Parallax View, where there's two people. One's the one that's saying, I can't recall, much like the witness there in the O.J. Simpson trial, Katie Kalin. Cato Kalin, right. He keeps saying that. But anyway, this is what's happened with that person that they put into prison, and he's sitting there for years, and he can't recall because they probably made him brain dead already in there once he's in incarceration. They can do anything to you.
Yeah, who are you talking about now? Who are you talking about?
I'm talking about the...
Sirhan Sirhan.
Now, I had long conversations with his lawyer. I see that when he did the case of James Earl Ray, why did the same lawyer get involved?
William Pepper.
And I said... because he did a TV movie, I think, with the History Channel or something like that, or Discovery Channel, where he had some low-life woman who never actually appeared at the hearings do a mock trial of the James Earl Ray and say, well, I was Raoul, and she said, oh, yeah, I heard him say that he was Raoul. You know, they put all these small-time hoods and hookers in there that for you know, 5,000, 10,000, maybe even 2,000 for their next fix will say anything. But she was too scared to even appear. And, you know, she gave an affidavit which was totally false. And then they write a book and then they make money with these false trials and false situations. But what came out of James Earl Ray's mouth is the truth. He met a fellow by the name of Raoul, which was my brother. I was there at the time. It was in Neptune Tavern. But I met...
Neptune Cavern
James
is where? Where's Neptune Cavern?
Montreal.
Where?
Montreal.
In Montreal.
Montreal, Canada. Right at the port.
This is before the assassination?
Yeah, this was just before the assassination.
Of
the
Martin Luther King.
Right. Yeah. I knew about it right at the time in 67, July. That's when I actually first saw James Earl Ray, and he was sitting with Walter Tobinski in a place called the Mercury Club, and that's where I first saw him. So I saw various times that I was asked to assist by trying to find out how you get a passport. So I went to the passport place where James Earl Ray actually got his passport, first asking how you get one to be done. Also, he needed photographs, so I went into a place where he had these photos taken prior to setting up the passport. Everything was done that he was supposed to get in and out of the country. But the guy was too slow, this James Earl Ray. But I knew about the assassination, just like I said, the 21st of September, year 1963, I knew about the assassination going to go down from the words of the mouth of Clyde Forshaw. It was planned.
Right, do you mean you said the 21st of September? Did you mean the 21st of November?
No, September.
You knew a month in advance.
Months in advance.
Yeah. Okay. Go ahead.
Now what happened is
months
Clyde
in advance.
Blew up.
Yeah, September, October, months November.
Is,
yeah.
Three. Right. Now what happened is JFK had just gone before the UN, and he had made a major statement to Israel. We want to look at your nuclear facilities. You're not allowed to have nuclear facilities. He wrote a letter, a very important letter, to Ben-Gurion, and the Israelis got put off by that. And as soon as he had stated that we want that facility to come down or to have inspectors in, that's when the HIP was going down. It was all, I couldn't believe it. Now, when I counted the days, this is what was so funny. Like I said, 62 days from the time of the assassination of my finding out of Kennedy's assassination, I counted, and it went down. The same thing from the time that Martin Luther was killed to Robert Kennedy being killed is the same time factor.
You knew. So you knew.
It's no coincidence.
You knew. You knew it. You knew in each case 62 days in advance they were going to occur.
Right. So it's either it's Masonic. I don't know where, but it was a freaky situation where when I was on with Nelsenthal doing Cloak and Dagger, I had made a statement as Moneypenny. I was saying to them that there's going to be an earthquake in Iraq, and I said that just prior to it happening. That came psychically to me, and that was on around the 21st or whatever of December, just before the earthquake happened the tsunami happened in the Indonesia area. Remember when that great tsunami wiped out how many people off the island?
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I had made a statement because there was an earthquake in California. And psychically, it came to me that there'll be an earthquake and there'll be devastation in Iran. And it happened in Rundam, Iran. So I came on the show saying, as Moneypenny, I said, stay tuned next year, same date, but it'll be in a different locale. And I said, it'll be in the Indonesia area, close to Sumatra. And I just said that off the top of my head. Next year, same time, but different locale. So as the impending time factor was coming, I just kept a pace of what was happening in the newspaper. And right on the front page of the Toronto Star masthead, there was juggled words where it said, La Sula Na Mi. And I showed it to a friend, and I said, do you see the jumbled words, La Sula La Mi, coming in front of you, just like it jumped on me? I didn't even actually see him, but I said, how did you see that? Like, you know, when I said, look at the masthead, do you see something in there? And they read the same words, but I said, how did this happen? So I counted from the day, and I'll scan this photo to you, of the masthead, and here it was, the tsunami happened 62 days right after this last tsunami was right in the masthead. So it's coordinated. Maybe because certain people make a tremendous amount of money through short selling, like they did the stocks of the American Airlines in the 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
So it's coordinated for certain select few to know that the take is going down at a certain date. People know how to read into the coding. But I just clued into it by chance like that. But that psychically, it came to me that the tsunami was going to happen. So from that point, I started just off the top of my head, I thought, let me see from the time that Martin Luther was killed to Bobby Kennedy was killed. And there it was. Same time factor. Blew me away. So I thought, this is a planned, coordinated takedown for certain entities to be taken out when they have to be taken out.
It's curious that you would learn about it on that time frame schedule. I mean, you're talking about learning about it 62 days in advance.
Right, but the first time it was a year in advance to my psychically cluing into it. But then as I was getting closer, I thought, hey, I just made a statement here, and it was on on 640 radio, which goes as far as the feet of the studio down to Pennsylvania. I don't know how many people heard me, but massive amounts of people called in and said Moneypenny was absolutely right. So I played, I was too scared to go on with my own voice at that particular time. So when I was on Cloak and Dagger with Nelson Thal and Shulman Skolnick, I played Moneypenny. Then I went on when I met you and I was doing my own show with Spyman, Agent Ladybug and Spyman. So I was trying to get the word out there, and I thought, no, I'm wasting my time here doing these shows. I have to hone in to the key thing is get all of these things down in an affidavit, present it before the government, and be pressure them into doing the investigation.
Tell me more about Bobby.
Bobby?
Yeah. Why they wanted?
I got off the train.
Why'd they want to knock off Bobby? How was that done?
Bobby was done with, like I said, the parallax view, where they had two individuals, the shooter and the other fellow, Sirhan, in the same outfit. And the shooter comes, but it wasn't Sirhan. It's the assassination, specialist that comes in and does the shot. So it happened so quickly, no one really knows who did it, but it was done in the film with Warren Beatty perfectly, and you start looking at it and you say to yourself, boy, did I miss that. And that's why that film is very important, the Parallax View, because it brings into the forefront of we have to analyze what goes down. If this is highly coordinated and highly organized, who is the shooter at what particular time? And the Zapruder film is very important because they haven't analyzed that fellow right in the front. Why are they analyzing all the time the Umbrella Man and the guy in the front, and who is this and who is that? You can actually see through the Zapruder film where the shooters would have been at any particular point in time. Certainly not, the headshot that blows Kennedy's skull away didn't come from the Texas School Depository. You could see it's coming from the area, the grassy knoll, or as I call it, the cement embankment retaining wall. I can't believe how many people are waylaid by life in general, and they never clue into analyzing and putting pressure on solving this. So they've once they did the assassination hearings, most of the key players were killed purposely, like DeMorn Shield. Did I say the name right this
yes,
time?
Yes, yes, you did.
Right. Now, the key thing was the wife made the statement before, and it has to be analyzed because I found it in a book, and she had said they were the wild boys from Canada that did the assassination.
Of JFK?
On JFK. So I met her. She was in my dad's house. So here was this very important person that was in before the hearings as part player, because Gene DeMornshield was working with Zapruder. Get that? In a dress manufacturing.
Yeah, Jennifer. Yeah,
he was a pattern cutter.
Jennifer Jr.
Oh, that's right. So it's very important because she was the wife of Gene DeMornshield. So why would I have met her? So I met a lot of the people that no one else had a history of seeing and knowing. So I knew about the assassination prior to it happening. I knew it was going to happen with an open limousine. Clyde used a gun getting access into the place where I lived at 54 Brownlow Avenue. He had just blown up the Oakville lumber yard, left a bottle of nitroglycerin in a phone booth, and with the same gun that he shot Tippett with, put that to my head and said, get me in the house, the cops are running after me, and I don't want to get caught. you know, blow you away, let me in the house.
Clyde shot Tippett?
Yeah, Clyde shot Tippett.
Was anyone with him?
Sorry?
Was anyone with him?
This is what happened, what was related to me by Clyde. Clyde said when the station wagon that was seen, and they have it in various colors, but it was a white and turquoise station wagon with Barry Goldwater for President bumper sticker. It had a Niagara Falls decal on the window of it. Now, it was seen by various witnesses that testified before the Warren Commission. Now, it's in the photographs in Robert Groden's book, and seen by an officer, Craig, who was killed also, that was at the scene right after the...
You're talking about Roger Craig.
Roger Craig, right. Now, he was in the forefront there looking at it when there's a picture of the station wagon coming down Elm Street, and the assassin is seen to jump in it. So it was my brother driving it, Clyde, who was just behind the retaining wall, then jumped over the picket fence, waited a bit of time, and then slowly just walked to the station wagon and took off. Now, as it took off from that Dealey Plaza area, Tippett started following this car and told the occupants to get out. Clyde had gotten out of the car before and came up to Tippett and shot him before Tippett could come out of his car and get to him. Clyde came out of his car, point blank, blew Tippett away there.
Blew Tippett away.
Sorry?
Blew Tippett away.
Blew Tippett away, right.
Was he the only shooter of Tippett, or was there somebody with him also shooting Tippett?
No, it was just Clyde there, and my brother took off in the station wagon. Clyde took off by foot, took off the jacket, and went through a service station or gasoline.
What jacket was he wearing?
Some sort of beige jacket, right? And then he said he put the jacket underneath the wheel of a car or whatever.
Was that his own jacket, or was that supposed to be an Oswald jacket?
That's supposed to be probably an Oswald jacket. That's where they started, analyzing whose jacket was where. But people should have analyzed, the hair off of that, the cigarette butts that were right behind the grassy knoll. They had DNA. No one secured that area.
Right, and it was all purposeful to wreck the scene.
That's right. So I can't get over it because I was almost one of the people when Clyde said, "Hey, you do the writing, you do the ordering of the Manlicher Carcano." I said, "Gee, man, I was only, 14 at the time." I said, "You fill it out here." So it was filled out from Toronto, posted, from the States. That was the setup, stupid. Why a mail order?
Oswald, yeah.
Yeah, why a mail order of, like, very cheap make of a gun when Oswald, living in Dallas, could buy a gun anywhere at any gun shop at any particular time? That's the question. Like, no one analyzes this thing. So what I was told by Clyde, that they use Mausers, all of a sudden the story changed, that when they first, secured the area, that they had brought down a Mauser. Oh, it changed the story when you see it live, coming on. It's not a Mauser anymore. It's now on a Manlicher Carcano. Oh, my God.
Did Clyde tell you how many times he shot Tippett?
He told me, but off the top of my head, I can't remember. I think usually what this is what he tells me. He points the gun straight to the person's skull and blows it away with one shot, right between the eyes. But sometimes that he's done maybe three or four shots to make sure the person is dead. So it could have been one, it could have been three. I don't remember because he told me so many, like how he blew this guy in front of the house, Salvatore Trombardi away, how many shots that was. But he had blown away a fellow who was the partner of the Camiso Boys Bakery, and he was a silent partner. Francesco Pisamenti. Now, Clyde said he knocked on the guy's window. The guy let down his driver's seat window, and he blew the guy's head away more than multiple shots, and he did it as usually hit guy only needs one shot, right point blank in the middle.
Are we talking still about Tippett?
Yeah, no, I'm talking about Clyde's shots where he's done people, shot people in their car, in their driver's seat,
okay.
And how he usually does it.
Okay.
So he's done this to an actual, this partner, much like he did Tippett. So, like, he's told me multiple times, so many times, he's told me how many shots went down, but because he's done so many of these, driver in the driver's seat, I can't think off the top of my head, like, oh, Tippett was three,
right.
This fellow Pisametti was like nine, like, you know,
can't. Other reports say that Tippett was shot three times in the torso, and then when he was lying down, he was shot in the right temple.
Right. Okay. That's right. He came out of the car. He shot him on the ground or whatever. Like, to me, I can't remember how many times he's told me this stuff over and over, but because there's so many people that he shot the same way, like, he tells me the story about the Cosimo Lombardo.
But he was the only shooter at Tippett.
Yeah, he was the only shooter. All I remember Clyde telling me that my brother was still in the station wagon. My brother took off, but Clyde did the shooting by himself of Tippett that I know about.
So Tippett stopped the Rambler.
Well, it wasn't the Rambler. It was like I told you, it was a car that was...
White and turquoise?
That's right.
The white and turquoise. But was it like a Ford or Chevy or something?
This is also what Clyde told me that they did, so they can't tell the make of the car. He would take the make of the car off. Let's say it was a car that looked like another car. He would actually take, if it was a Hyundai or a Honda or a Hyundai or whatever, he'd take those metal plates away so that the person couldn't tell one from another.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That type of thing.
Those are probably more recent killings then, because Hyundai has only been in the United States for a short time. And
right.
I don't even know that Honda, I don't think even Honda was available in 1963.
Right. So Clyde has a Korean model car that I was in time and time again. So
it's a very obscure kind of car.
That's right.
So it'd be very difficult to identify.
Right. But what he would do is in the places that they use as a diversionary car, they would have a Honda, same type of model or whatever, same year, but a different make.
How many?
And with stolen license plates, and he put it in this, where he used to live, in this chop shop, and they would, set up these cars for the takedown. So it's coordinated. I think from way back when, to also say it was a Rambler, it was a this, a that, or whatever. and the fellow who made the statement was found dead, the one who was in the tower.
Holland, Max or Sam Holland, yeah.
Right, so all of the people...
He had anything to do with that? He had to do with Holland?
Everyone who was part of the assassination, including Ferry, had to be taken out as soon as they started speaking before the government.
Yeah,
so
or the Jim Garrison trial investigation.
Yeah, the Jim Garrison trial. So I found it very interesting that they were killed, that David Ferry was killed and the Cuban guy was killed there. They got an axe to the head.
Yeah.
The same night. Now,
I think that he was down in Little. I think he was killed down in Little Havana, if I'm not mistaken.
That's right.
Yeah.
So, who got an axe right in the middle of the forehead by Walter Tobinski was a woman in Toronto, a Jewish lady. And that story is horrific, but that both of them told me, because they used to scare the living bejesus out of me, that I get an axe in my forehead all the time if I say anything. The axe was a display model, and Walter Tobinski told me that he had walked into the store, taken the model axe from its display case in the window,
yeah,
walked up to the Jewish lady, the proprietor, and asked to get a few items, bought a few items, and then when she wasn't quite looking at him because she was counting the yards of this rope, anyway, that he'd use in strangulation, he hit her with the axe and right in the middle of the forehead.
Why was he killing her?
Jewish lady at 666 Yonge Street. Get that number. 666
yeah.
Yonge Street.
Right.
All right. He tells me he pulls the woman behind the counter, and the door is still open, so another customer comes in, and he's got blood of her splattered on his face. And he does with no qualms, no fear, whatever, "May I help you?" The woman saw the murder. You know, she said she heard sounds of groaning. She wasn't quite dead yet, this woman. And she heard sounds of groaning, that it was like a dog sound.
Yeah.
The woman was still lying half dead or on the way of dying right behind the counter, get that.
Right.
Anyway, Scott, they had the composite of this woman, the eyewitnesses of all these people. That's an unsolved case, just like this Cuban guy. But how many people would take an axe right to somebody's forehead just like that?
What?
He's so calm about it.
Why did
he have to look at...
Why did he kill her?
Why did he kill her?
Yeah.
This is why I think a lot of these cases were covered up here in Canada. There was a Soviet Union defector by the name of Grishenko that came out and started talking about so many spies, and a lot of them were from the Soviet Union, and they were Jews, and they were being mowed down by Tobinski. And there's been suppressed evidence that the Canadian government had suppressed into these cases.
So she was a Soviet spy?
Could possibly be.
She was spying for the Soviets, though. I mean, you know.
That's right. There was an article that I've kept that there were more than 6,000 spies at the particular time. There was a breakthrough first in France that spies have moved into to throughout Europe. There was a takedown of the of a number of spies. It was based on Grishenko's information. He was shown to the media with a sleeping, or say like a pillowcase over his head with the eyes, you know, much like someone who's a KKK man.
Yeah.
That sort of outfit that he came on into the press and made a statement. But a lot of the individuals, I think, that were covered up. Now, what was very interesting was the story that they told me of why this Marie Lip, I can't even pronounce her name here. Anyway, a woman that came from Ukraine.
She's the one who got the axe in the head?
No, she wasn't. She was, her name was Dirksen. I'll give you the date and the time. I don't have it right in front of me.
Sure.
Here, let me just try to bring it up. I'll go away from the Zapruder film and just bring out the cold cases. Now, this has been covered up here in Canada. A lot of them have that Walter Divinity and Clyde did, so that anyone, you know, that's sort of cluing in.
This was Walter, though, who gave her the axe in the head, right?
That's right.
I
told you that I lived with the fellow who was from the Naval Intelligence. His name is Charles Frederick Rogers.
Yes.
And his photo was also made public as one of the three tramps that was arrested at Dealey Plaza going.
Right, he was the first of the three. He was the first of the three tramps. Yes.
That's right. Now I met him in 66. Wait a minute, let me try to think.
You met Charles Rogers in 1966 or so?
Wait a minute, 66 or 67, let me try to think. Expo, I always have to think about Expo 67. It was 66, yeah. First of all, in December 66. And my brother had brought him through the state of Washington into Canada because he was wanted for the icebox murders of his parents. Supposedly he had cut off the heads of his parents in an icebox. And he was not, there was a book written about the icebox murders.
The Man on the Grassy Knoll.
Right, The Man on the Grassy Knoll. Now, the reason that they stayed in the book of why he killed his parents was the fact that he kept a journal of what went on and who was at the Dealey Plaza.
Oh, really?
And that's right. So I got to know him, and I don't believe for a second that he did his parents in. I think who did it was Clyde and Walter Dubinsky, because they're taking people's heads off almost, and I want to show you, on a daily, weekly basis. You know, to take an axe to somebody's forehead or to chop a person into pieces, you have to be made of strong stuff and do, you know, mercenary work for years.
And have no conscience whatsoever.
That's right. And he became a mercenary. Walter Dubinsky wrote this book, or he didn't write, but he stated to an LAPD officer, and it was written a book, it was called, good grief, I have it. It's a pocketbook anyway. It was 6 Seconds in Dallas or something like that.
No, that was written by a guy named Josiah Thompson.
Okay, no, that's the wrong name. Anyway, something at Dealey Plaza. I have the book. Anyway, I have to scan it and then...
Okay.
Anyway, scan it and then show you the thing, because I was given the book by Walter himself. his own copy.
Did they ever tell you how many shooters there were in Dealey Plaza?
I would say from knowing how many other than my brother and that, I would say that there was a total of one in the... Tex Mal building, one in the...
you mean Daltex? Daltex.
Daltex, right. One in the Texas School Depository. One, what he himself told me was he was the badge man. Clyde was the black dog man. So that's two, right?
Yeah.
One was actually, I think, in a pickup truck on the other side of Elm Street.
Who was that? Yeah.
Somebody was in a pickup truck.
Okay.
Hidden. I'll show you the photos. So Dal text.
Book depository. And
well, let's say at least six shooters. And with Tabinski there, and then the walkie-talkie guys and the guys coordinating it. I don't really know how many. I would surmise, as I remember, they said something like six shooters, and then walkie-talkie men and guys placed.
Who set them up? Who paid? Who they were paid for this, right?
Yeah, and they were paid by this Lewis Bloomfield. I said, well, who cut the check in the end? Where did you get the check from? Where did that come from? Now, Lewis Bloomfield was in Montreal, and he stated that he was the point person as well, I think, and the documents have been waylaid by the wife because she said that he was supposed to, after Lewis Bloomfield's death, released them after 30 years. So it's even coordinated all this documentation that had to be kept secret and the, you know, any kind of evidence. Well, now, who's tried to go through and seen this documentation was one of the authors I told you that I spoke to on the phone as well, the man who wrote The Man Who Knew Too Much about Nagel's influence. Dick Russell. Now, Dick Russell was going to come up from, I think he's in Connecticut or whatever, but he ended up going down to the Baja meeting Jesse Ventura, so he was going to come up and interview me because he thought, I got to put this down just in case this woman is killed, but she knows. Now, Nagel's story is that there was somebody that met in Mexico City to cut the check or give the check to Walter Tabinski. He's now taken in videos of, or not videos, but photographs of Walter Tabinski as being the guy who is the other Oswald.
Yeah.
Of Mexico City.
You mean the one who was photographed in Mexico City?
That's right.
Guy's kind of a big guy with a bush haircut. Looks like he might be a football player.
Exactly.
And who is that? Who actually is that?
Walter Tabinski.
That's actually Walter Tabinski in that photograph?
That's right. That's Walter Tabinski there. So they were supposed to go to, the assassination team to Cuba to kill Castro. They were all set up, you know, prior to it. Now, interesting, because last week I looked at an FBI agent just recently had done a video, and he said that the agents, and this is the direct words I got out of both Tabinski and Clyde, that they were set up to go to Miami, but they ended up killing JFK, part because Tabinski was one of the individuals who went into the Bay of Pigs and got no backup. So he had a grievance against Kennedy as well, because there was no backup, and he had stated that in that book I told you that was written by the LAPD officer at Dealey Plaza. Good grief. Let me see if I can find it here. Anyway, so that's very important. All of these things have partly come out. The FBI agent saying that this was a coordinated takedown, supposedly of Castro going forth, but he couldn't get in. He was denied entry, Walter Tabinski. He was trying to speak in Russian, but he didn't know how to speak. He's Ukrainian. Walter is Ukrainian. He knows a few Russian words, but he wasn't fluent like Oswald was. So they denied entry, but they used to kill people to get passports and then try to get into countries with the various passports. That's where
they'd kill them so they could use it, so they could adopt their identity.
That's right. And someone without a criminal record is easy. That's why the case with James Earl Ray, they had to find someone that would get a passport easy with no criminal record.
So Clyde and Walter and Raul, your brother's name is Raul?
My brother, right. Yeah, there are a lot of people.
Wait a minute. They were all three in Dealey Plaza.
Right.
Clyde, Walter, and Raoul.
That's right. Where was
your brother at the time of the shooting?
Well, he was behind a picket fence. My understanding is he parked the car, the station wagon. First, he would get a look around as the fellow upstairs.
Yeah.
And I thought he, had parked the car in the picket fence area or close by, because they had to coordinate the getaway just as soon as.
Sam Hollum saw him drive in there in the station wagon, I think.
Right. Now, some of the books, the one that I just recently got, and the guy that made the movie, The Dead, here, hold on, I have the book right here. I finally got this, paid a pretty penny for an old library copy. I couldn't believe that I got this book here. Where did I put it here? Give me one second.
Sure.
Okay, in Dallas, are you there?
I'm listening. Yeah, your voice changed.
Yeah, Josiah Thompson. Now, there's a page that says that there's a guy, a shooter, in Dealey Plaza, standing on the station wagon, on the bumper of the station wagon, or not the bumper.
What page?
Here, I found it, and I thought, gee, is that my brother?
What page is it?
As well. Just let me try to find it. I had it here at some point. It's a smaller picture.
What page?
Let's try.
I got the book in my hand.
Ages when I went through it page by page, and I think
it was page 128.
Let me see here. 120.
127, 126.
Yeah, that's, hold on, just give me a second. It's close to the back, I thought.
Oh, okay.
But anyway, it's in there where it says the shooter is seen firing from standing on, either the open car door or the bumper of the station wagon. They say station wagon. I thought, you've got to be kidding here.
How could they tell it was a station wagon?
And that photograph of it, but it, like...
In the Knicks film...
The Knicks film is the most important that has to be actually slowed down. Frame by frame.
Okay, go to page 224.
In the same book?
Yeah.
224. Right, yeah. Like, those types of pictures with these people have to be enlarged and analyzed. That's where I started looking at all these pictures in Robert Groden's book.
Yeah.
And based on, I had brought the book and started reading it and showing all the pictures to Clyde, then said, please show me where you were, right? Where the shooters were.
Yeah.
So he marked the book. I don't want you to ever record this to anyone. Here we have it. If you just look on page 36.
Okay, wait a second. Page 36.
Yeah, you could see the Walter Tobinski, the guy with the fedora hat, the black guy with the fedora hat. So his hand.
I thought Walter was wearing the vest.
That's right. He's with a bulletproof vest. So there you see the still shot of that Zapruder film there.
Uh huh.
Or JFK's already clutching his sort of throat area.
And Walter's in the vest. Who's the fedora guy in the fedora hat?
I got to find out who that fedora, because Clyde told me who he was, too.
Because he was with
and
him, right?
I can't, when he told me all this, we're talking about 2000. So he talked about exactly how he'd done Tippett, I don't want to say how I have it, but I have it. He describes everything to me exactly as it went down. So I can't remember offhand, like when you asked me how, where was he standing, what was he doing. He told me, but because he told me so many other homicides after that he had done.
Yeah.
In a car, near a car, by a car, in a plaza. You know, they're happening, like I said, if you did this takedown.
Well, why don't you go through the pages and tell me where he located everybody?
Yeah, let me try to find that. I'll go slowly as we're talking, so I'll try to ask me a question, and I'm flipping pages here.
Right.
So that I will find this. This is highly important.
Yes.
This is where I wanted to meet with Robert Groden, and then I finally found his, there's that photo. I said, what's Walter doing now with bulletproof vest on the other side, you know, looking.
You're still on page 36, or is this somewhere else?
No, I think that's the shot that I told you.
On pages on pages 70 and 71, well, actually 69, 70, 71, he's in the background several times.
Right. Well, this 228 is the
You're on
one
page 228?
Yeah, I think that's the one where Walter Chavinsky is right in the back. The Umbrella Man has an arrow pointed to him.
Right.
But Walter Chavinsky with the bulletproof vest. So there's key photos of him.
Well, where's Walter in that photo on 228?
I think in the back, right in the back.
You mean up above the Umbrella Man?
Now, if you look, there's the 7389.
Huh?
There's a woman, and then there's another one with the leg moving. If you could take a look, right, there's a woman directly in above the Umbrella Man, but look more to the west side of the woman there.
To the left of the woman? Toward
to the left, right. There's a man there.
Way in the back, sort of in
man?
Front of the column?
Sorry? Yeah,
between,
right directly.
Between her and the stem and sign?
Yeah, there's a column, and he's right in front of the column there. That is, I think, the smaller picture that I saw in the Robert Groden.
And that's Walter?
Yeah, because that's the same guy with the bulletproof vest. Now, what's very important is the Alton film has been cut where he actually, the close-up of Walter's clothing is seen, so you can analyze it between the Graydon fellow and Kavinsky, so you know exactly what clothing was worn. No one's analyzed the clothing that these people wore. Now, Clyde said he had different outfit, but there's a photograph.
You're talking about the Alton's. You're talking about the Alton's photograph toward the book depository, and you're going to have.
Oh, here I finally found it. Yeah, it's page 224, and it said this frame from the Nick film was thought by many to show a man firing a rifle from a roof of a station wagon.
Right, and that would have been. Clyde?
No, Clyde was behind the retaining wall.
Well, was that, you mean that? Well, who was that in 224?
Well, that could have been, my brother, because who would stand on the station wagon other than the owner, right? I always thought that my brother was just a getaway driver and not an actual shooter, but. Because he was on the property of the British Petroleum people shooting a sniper rifle for months on end with a scope. He actually fell from this tree. He was up in trees and firing from afar. He became a crack shot from huge
distance. What was your brother's last name?
The last name that we had at the time of the killing was O-T-T-A-S, Roland Odom. So if you go into the...
O-T-T-A-S?
Right. So Google this, and then you'll see that it'll come up. Or put
wait a minute. Roland Otis?
Roland Otis. But put this here so that you'll see it'll come up.
Okay.
Google. Let me go .com. And then I'm going to put Raul.
Yeah, what do you want me to put in my search window?
Yeah, how do you spell Raul again?
R-A-O-U-L, probably.
And R-A-U...
O-U-L.
Oh, right, that's right. O-U-L... And then you put Roland with double L. R-O-double.
Okay.
And let me see if I find it, because it came up with a guy who wrote...
But Otis? Well, we need Otis on there?
No, you can't find it with Otis, but you'll find... Oh, good grief.
Raul Roland...
Philip, I keep forgetting this author's name.
Melanson?
No, Philip, he became one of the archivists for the Robert Kennedy assassination.
Yeah.
Philip... And he started doing the research for the... Oh, I know what I'll do. I'll put Martin Luther King or
Raul in relation to MLK, sure.
Yeah, hold on. And then it might pop up here, King. Because it's right in a book. Where you see my brother and this Neptune Tavern. Philip, I'm trying to find the book here.
James Earl Ray, the man who killed Martin Luther King.
No, James Earl Ray was not the person who killed
him. Yeah, no, there's the name of the book. I'm trying to just talk about the name of the book. I know he didn't shoot him.
Hold on. If I did, Phil... I can't ever remember his name.
Haley, I got to step away just a second.
You know, archivist that was on, it starts with Philip and he's dead now.
I don't know. You got to excuse me just a sec. I got to take a leak. I'll be right back.
Okay. Oh, here it is.